From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the August 2024 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Inside Hut 6. Hut 6 was the section at Bletchley Park which broke the German Army and Air Force Enigma ciphers. Historical accounts usually focus on the early part of the war, when a small and inexperienced team was established in a newly built wooden hut. But by 1944, Hut 6 looked very different. It was a hardened unit of several hundred people, supported by cutting-edge technology. Hut 6 personnel had honed their methods through bitter experience against Enigma ciphers, which continued to increase in both number and security. Recent research into Bletchley Park's unique collections has revealed more about how this vital section worked. We have discovered how they kept the intelligence production line running despite fighting a daily battle not just against the ciphers, but against the dangers of inefficiency, poor morale, and organisational friction. For this episode, Research Officer Dr. Thomas Cheatham is joined by Bletchley Park digitisation volunteer and all-round brain box Craig Heath to take a detailed look inside Hut 6. Many thanks to Sarah Langston and Joel Desborough for voicing our archival documents. A slightly different episode this month, where I'll be taking a bit of a back seat and Tom will be leading this episode. Tom, can you give us a bit of detail why we want to have this look inside Hut 6? Because Gordon Welshman wrote a book about Hut 6, didn't he? That told the whole story, didn't it?
He did, and you know, kind of a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, at this point will be thinking, well, we know all about Hut 6 because we talk about it every week in some way. It's the most famous part of the whole Bletchley Park operation, with the possible exception of Hut 8 doing Naval Enigma. Hut 6, I should be clear, is working on Army Air Force Enigma traffic. This is where the cryptanalysts are working, generating decrypts that go over to Hut 3 for translation and reporting. So this is the absolute core of the operation. But I still think there's a lot more to be said about it. And we've been doing a bit of work to understand how Hut 6 worked on quite a detailed level based on some of our collections.
Now, when you say we, this isn't just you, is it?
No, and I'm hoping most of the expertise here comes from one of our volunteers who's been working on the Digi project here since 2013, who is Craig Heath, who's joining us for this episode, and we're very pleased to have him because the knowledge he's been able to build up about the procedures in Hut 6, I think, is possibly unique. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background and about what you do at BP and how you came to be interested in the story?
I'll try and make it not the entire podcast, as it is a long story. I started volunteering at Bletchley Park in 2013. And that was when the archives started what we call the digitization project. So the idea is to take digital copies of all of the materials that we hold in the archive and index them to make them more accessible. So I started off when I was working for myself, so I was able to spare a half day a week to work on that. And since that time, I'm now retired, so I've been able to spend more time on it. If I move on to the topic of this podcast, about 2 years ago, I was allocated what we call the Red Messages, which is a collection of intercepts from 4 days in November 1944. And these messages were in a bundle that had become disordered over the years. So I think it's been with the Trust maybe 20 years, something like that. And so I initially started essentially cataloguing these messages, typing up the headers from the intercepts.
So they were a bit of a mess, weren't they? They were out of order and there wasn't really good information about what they were or what they could tell us.
Different parties had a different idea of what the nature of this collection actually was. So I think perhaps I was the first to actually go through them all and catalogue them in a sense. And we discovered that they were, in fact, almost all messages which were on a particular Enigma key that was used by the German Air Force. And they were predominantly from these particular 4 days in November 1944. So as part of trying to figure out what the correct order of the messages was, because we needed to number each sheet so that we could reference them and store them correctly in the archives, as part of figuring that out, I realized there was an awful lot of information in various forms on these pieces of paper. And I should say it's approximately 300.
So it's about 300 sheets. And if you break that down into individual messages, we have 214 messages in total across 4 days, split into 338 individual message parts, because our regular listeners will know that an Enigma message is, according to the regulations at least, 250 characters long. So longer messages are split into more than one part.
There are various ways of slicing and dicing what we have in this collection, indexing it by sheet or by message part or by message. And so my investigations basically started with trying to figure out the best way to do that. And kind of incidentally to that, noticed that there was a lot of information on these sheets that we didn't fully understand. There were handwritten annotations, ink annotations, rubber stamps of dates and times that, frankly, we didn't exactly know what they meant. So,
but they all meant something.
That they obviously meant something, and they were important to Hut 6 at the time, otherwise they wouldn't have wasted time writing these things down.
Yeah, the trap I really fell into, because I always looked at these messages and just kind of got boggled by the complexity of them. And as far as I could work out, some of them were marked as duplicates, some of them were marked as duds, so indecipherable messages. Some of them I could make out bits of plain text German that said things like tuning message, Abstimmspruch, and they didn't look all that interesting. But if you try and make sense of all those different components and what they're all there for and try and perceive how the system works, you realise it's actually a very significant collection and it can tell us a lot about how Hut 6 worked. But to go back to the initial point, we're looking at Hut 6 at a period much later in the war. This is November 1944. This is kind of Hut 6 at its peak.
This is when Hut 6 is in Block D. This is why we mentioned Welshman's book at the beginning, because Welshman's talking about the early part of the war, really.
Yeah, Welshman is writing from memory in the early 1980s. He does a very good job of explaining how Hut 6 gets off the ground and what it was like to be there in the beginning. But of course, we tend to find from our veterans that they tend to remember day one much better than they do most days of their service. And if they're here for a number of years, you will get a better impression of the early time of their service than later on. And so Welshman does gloss over, rather, you know, the late war period.
And it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it, by then? It's become industrialised.
Yeah, it's a completely different organisation by that point. Hut 6 is much larger. It's much more formalised in many ways, although something we'll mention is how organic this organisation is and how it never stops changing, never stops developing. But we need to understand that late war period, because that's when Hut 6 and Bletchley Park more broadly generates the most intelligence. This is the peak period.
So each of those notes and annotations and rubber stamps mean something, don't they?
They were not just meaningful at the time, they were vital because they are how these pieces of paper make their way through the system and how the dozens of people who have to handle them understand where they've been and where they're going and what they need to do with them. And a fascinating part of this for me, I think, is how analog this process is and how human-centered it is. And it is just a very well orchestrated process of pieces of paper going down the line and different people putting different markings on them and treating them in different ways. That means you kind of input unbroken messages and you get out decrypts. And then they go on to tell the Allies things which are unknowable from any other source and sometimes really vital in the prosecution of the war. And so we have an opportunity here to really drill down to the detail of what that process looked like at a very individual level. Instead of just saying, well, Hut 6 decrypts German messages, that's such a top-level statement, it doesn't really tell you how it happened. And so we want to draw out a bit of that complexity today.
Night has fallen over Paris, and the wet chill of European autumn has filled the dark streets. Jeeps and trucks with headlights blazing are rushing through the blacked-out streets of Paris, heading for the front, where Supreme Allied Headquarters reports a quickening of the fighting tempo. With the American wedge and the Siegfried Line now securely anchored at Aachen, the British front in Holland has stepped up its activity for the first time since the lull following the British paratroop stand at Arnhem. Right now, the ground in Northern Europe is soaked and muddy, especially in Holland. It's not suitable for large-scale military operations that demand coordination between infantry, tanks, and air force. You know, early autumn is Europe's rainy season, and it may be 2 or 3 weeks before the ground is dried out and hardened by frost, and before the skies are clear enough for sustained action by our air force. Meantime, the 9th U.S. Air Force is making the area between the Siegfried Line and the Rhine very unhealthy. Patrols of low-flying American fighter bombers sweep up and down, gunning and bombing. And the Germans are worried over this threat to the industrially vital Rhineland and Ruhr. For the first time since D-Day, the Luftwaffe has been ordered up to fight off the aggressive American planes, to try to keep our pilots from cutting all the German communications with the Rhineland. But even though they're fighting over their German fatherland, the Luftwaffe cannot prevent those white-starred American planes from slashing at everything that moves in the Rhineland. This is Larry Lester returning you now to New York.
The thing is, Craig, isn't it true to say that part of the value of this collection we have is that it's not that special? These messages aren't outstanding. They haven't been selected for being particularly significant.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, we believe, essentially the complete collection of, we call them red messages because the Enigma key they're encrypted in was known as red. We have the complete collection of red messages for these 4 days at the beginning of November 44. And it, yes, it's not been edited. So we can see a typical day's traffic and the typical ways in which they were attempting to break the daily key for each of those days.
And that's the point. Unless you've looked at these messages, I think people don't realise, because let's be honest, the vast majority of messages are mundane, aren't they? I mean, how many thousands, tens of thousands of messages have you looked at, Tom?
I mean, luckily, my job is mostly to look at the final decrypt. And even then, you look for 1,000 of the Enigma messages that are actually selected for sending out to commands at high priority. Mm. And 99% of them are really dull. And so the traffic that's actually not being reported is even less significant, on an individual level at least.
But it plays a role, doesn't it?
It's all part of the big picture. And I suppose that's another point to make here, that these teams of people are able to build up very, very valuable knowledge from individual messages, which are individually worthless. I think it's fair to say you lose one of these messages on average, and you don't lose a lot. But you put them all together, and they're able to do pretty amazing things with them.
I think it depends on your perspective. As Tom says, his interests lean towards actually the military intelligence that's coming out at the end of the process. From my perspective, and I've had a 30-year career as a computer security practitioner, I'm interested in the cryptanalysis part, so the core competencies of HUT-6. And a mundane message is way more useful cryptanalytically than an unusual message. I expect our listeners have heard of the notion of CRIBS, which is guessing a portion of the encrypted message and then trying it against the message to see if the guess is correct. And typically, the German operators would start the day by sending out tuning messages with a very similar format. So that was a very useful place to start, saying, can we figure out some Enigma settings that will decode to the German word Abstimmspruch, which is tuning message.
Maybe that's a good way into talking about the first part of this process, because it all starts with interception, of course. So the first thing we wanted to understand is, what are the indications on these messages about how that process was all orchestrated? We have a series of Y stations, we have a network of about 300 sites in the UK, intercepting all sorts of different traffic. But they're not doing that randomly. It's a very carefully orchestrated process. So we can tell from the preambles of each of these messages, which is coming in, when it's intercepted, where it's intercepted. You have all the information about the German side of the process. You have the German call signs. You have the frequency. You have the German time of origin, which is their recognition for that message. You were able to deduce a lot, weren't you, Craig, about how that system's orchestrated on the British side?
It was illuminating to compare the format of the intercepts that arrived from different Y stations. And we particularly saw a distinct difference in the format between the Y stations that were managed by the Foreign Office and the Y stations that were managed by the British Army and RAF. And that, we subsequently found out, was actually due to some of the security measures on the Allied side. So the Foreign Office intercept stations were not given the same background and insight into the German procedures as the military Y stations were. And by comparing those, we can see the value add, if you like, of the military intercept stations, that they actually did a lot of figuring out of what the traffic was before it even arrived at Bletchley Park.
Our messages are actually, they're just on the cusp of a big change in procedure on the German side. The Germans throughout the war have been using unpredictable call signs. But by 1944, the British have a good understanding of how these are allocated, and they're able to predict the call signs ahead of time. and inform the intercept stations the call signs in use on the networks they'll be listening in on, and then the operators know what to listen out for. And that's the chief difference, isn't it, between the military and the Foreign Office stations, is that the military have copies of the German call sign books. They're able to do that prediction themselves a lot of the time. But our messages don't actually illustrate this, but what happens just at the time they're being created on the side of the interception of German army traffic is that the Germans stop using predictable call signs and they tell their signals officers in the field to generate lists of random call signs, which HUT-6, you know, they're not random to the Germans, but HUT-6 fundamentally can't predict them. So now you have a problem of identifying traffic and directing interception, which didn't exist before. And you will have an even bigger problem when the Air Force does the same thing in February 1945. And that will cause big problems for HUT-6. And at that point, they actually have to reorganize the whole process, don't they?
Indeed. So there were a couple of stages, actually, of obfuscation on the part of the Germans, in that part of the preamble to the message that was sent out by the German operator is what's called the discriminant. And this follows the call signs, typically. The discriminant is something that is present on the key sheet for that Enigma key, and it helps the receiver of the message to know which key sheet they should be using to decrypt that message. But in the same way, it helps the enemy, the Allies, to also know that and know which key to decrypt the message. So discriminants were dropped fairly early on, beginning in 43, I think.
But that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because we often read about discriminants being dropped, I think it's in the middle of 1943, but not completely. And I think we'll come back to that, because they still play a role, don't they? But yeah, the Germans stop giving the British a nice, easy way of categorising messages into different keys.
Yes, and that's relating to one of the security devices that was introduced later in the war by the Germans, a new type of reflector wheel inside the Enigma machine, which was called Umkehrwalzer D, or Reflector D.
Or Uncle Dick to Bletchley Park.
Oh, Uncle Dick, indeed, to many at Bletchley Park. And that's when discriminants started to be used by the German operators again, because the recipient needed to know whether this new reflector had been used or whether they were using the old reflector. Perhaps in rather poor cryptographic operational procedure, they did use both reflectors on keys interchangeably, which made it much easier for HUT-6 to break into the daily key on the old reflector. And then they simply remained the problem of figuring out what the wiring of the new reflector was. And that was a monthly process, as it typically changed on the first of the month.
But the challenge here, isn't it, is working out which message is on which reflector, based on pretty scant clues from the Germans. And as far as we can work out, they're not actually using the discriminants for that, are they?
They seem to use the discriminant fairly consistently for stations that use either reflector.
Right.
So an important piece of information that was added onto the intercepts by the military Y stations was what's known as the A serial, also known as the air serial in some places. And this identifies the group of the German military which is sending these messages.
Well, we're talking about traffic analysis. We've talked about traffic analysis on the podcast before. And the idea that you can, without breaking any messages, you can look at message traffic and you can work out a picture of the enemy radio system and, by extension, their order of battle and their actual organisation. So these A serials would relate to a particular part of that jigsaw. If you think about the traffic analysts putting together different radio networks in their various kind of permutations, whether they're stars or lines or circles, and they characterise them in different ways, but they work out how they're constructed. And then they take them and they put them on their wall charts, their Morrison walls, and build up the big picture of how the enemy organization works. And then you can take those different elements and you can give them a designation. And you can, as I said before, start to predict the call signs and frequencies they're going to use. And then you can feed that information back to the intercept operators.
So the A serials are used for two distinct purposes. They are essentially a shorthand for the unit of the German military organization that is sending and receiving the messages. But what they actually represent is a column in a book of randomized call signs. So if you're in possession of that call sign book, you can kind of reverse engineer it, which is what the Y stations actually did, and figure out this sending station is using this column of the call sign book, and we've thereby identified what unit it is.
So it takes them about 2 years to do this at the start of the war. The army get on with analysing call signs pretty much immediately, but it's not until the end of 1941, I think, that they have a good idea of what the call sign book actually looks like, and they've just had to build it up over time based on the traffic they're hearing every day. And then ironically, they're pretty much at the end of that process of reconstructing the book, and then they capture one in North Africa during Operation Crusader. And then when that gets back to Britain, then that saves them all the trouble. But at least they can confirm that all their assumptions were right. But there are a couple of other call sign books, aren't there, that come into use later in the war, and they have to reconstruct those. The Germans, in quite characteristic style, they take certain shortcuts, don't they, in the process, especially when the F book comes in.
The last book that was used, which is called the Fox book or the F book, was reconstructed by, I guess, Sixter is the party principally responsible for that.
Main Bletchley Park Enigma traffic analysis section.
And what they were able to make use of was at some point they realised that essentially someone had chopped up the previous book into little chunks and randomly rearranged them. So by identifying groups of call signs in the new book, they were able to figure out what call signs were in the vicinity. So I think it was groups of 32 call signs or thereabouts.
Yeah, so what I actually found in the archive a while back down at Kew, but I didn't really understand what it was until we had this discussion about the F book, was there's a sort of chart that's a table that's been divided up into different coloured areas. It looks a bit like a game of Tetris. It's all these different shapes. And so it's a diagrammatic representation of how the Germans had chopped up the second call sign book, which they used, the E book, known as the Elephant book, to generate the F book. And I stress at this point, we've been talking for maybe 15 minutes and we haven't even got on to talking about encryption yet. This is all about how the Germans organised their own radio nets. And that's the first element of this, which the Allies have to almost decrypt to even start breaking messages. It's just what a message is, which key it is on, who sent it to whom.
Given that the Y station has identified the A serial of the communicating parties, they then can make a good guess as to whether those stations are going to be using the old reflector, the new reflector, or both interchangeably. And in practice, it seems that messages were tried on both reflectors for most of the messages in this collection. But they had an idea of which to try first, and in the main, they were right. And that's partly based on the discriminants that we talked about.
But it's not just about the reflectors, it's about working out which cipher key is in use as well.
So we should probably say that these red messages are a small part of all of the intercept traffic that came in. And red was an important key in that it was relatively easy to break and then gave you perhaps cribs onto other keys that were harder to break. Maybe it was a key like Jaguar that use the new reflector all the time.
Well, red was always the most important key for Hut 6, wasn't it? It was the first one to be broken on a large scale and sort of operationally, as they call it. So that when the first time in 1940 that they're reading messages almost as fast as the Germans are reading them, it's all red traffic. But the situation by 1944 is completely different because the Germans have tried to introduce as many different cipher keys as possible in the understanding that that makes stuff harder for the enemy cryptanalysts. So most of the really important operational traffic is now on specialist keys by this point in the war. You have a cockroach key used by night fighters. You've got various keys used in Italy, keys used in the Balkans, keys used for logistics. And that means your red general key, from an intelligence point of view, isn't as valuable as it used to be. But as you're quite right to say, Craig, it's still vital to break because it gives you ways into all those other ciphers. And also, it is still in use in the areas where there isn't a specialist key. So there are some operations going on out there which are best illuminated by red just because the units involved haven't got a good alternative.
And now for news direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to London. Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
The spotlight has for the moment shifted back to the air war in Western Europe. Our ground forces are engaged from Holland to Switzerland in comparatively small-scale actions and in various places along the front where we are advancing. This progress is hard fought against determined German forces. It's only in the air that we hear once more of huge formations striking heavy blows at the enemy's strength. Once again today, the United States 8th Air Force sent 2,000 planes into the Reich to bomb railroad marshalling yards on the approaches to the Western Front. You'll notice that railroad and communications targets appear more and more frequently in the reports of air warfare. Even when large American forces concentrate on oil and industrial targets, there are usually smaller bomber formations and fighters going after key railroad junctions and yards. And along with the great armadas of heavy bombers, the medium and fighter bombers of the tactical air forces are streaking out to hit smaller targets behind the German lines. It reminds you of the time before D-Day, when roads and crossings and bridges and railroad installations were pounded incessantly, hit again and again to pin the enemy down and give us the advantage of mobility. And once again in this great offensive, the RAF is sending its Lancasters and Halifaxes roaring out by day and by night. More than 1,000 of them dropped over 3,000 tons of bombs on Bochum and the Ruhr last night in the face of a flak barrage as heavy as anything ever put up in the Battle of the Ruhr and of great German fighter opposition. I'm told on good authority that the output of German fighter planes has never been higher than it is right now, because we've been concentrating on bombing other targets. The enemy hasn't enough fuel to sustain an effort by his fighter force, but he probably has gas enough to get large numbers of fighters into the air in emergencies. On the air, as well as on the ground, we've still got stiff fighting ahead.
Now, in preparation for this, you've kindly given me some printouts here of different types of messages, different forms. They're all different. Can you explain what the difference is between these and what they all are?
The bulk of the messages in this collection arrived at Bletchley Park by teleprinter. And so in that case, you can fairly easily recognise the typography. And you can see that it's then been subsequently amended by various different hands in various different styles and pencils and whatnot. However, there are a few messages which didn't arrive by teleprinter. Some of them arrived, we can deduce, by dispatch rider, because they are handwritten on something called a WT Red form. This is the form that the radio operators in the Y station used to actually transcribe the Morse code as they were listening to it on their headphones, and they would write it down on these red forms. And routinely, the red forms were sent to Bletchley Park by dispatch rider from the individual Y stations, but we believe that the majority have been discarded pertaining to this collection because the teleprints were sufficient. The few WT Red forms that we have were evidently a better representation of the intercept than what had been teleprinted.
And these red forms, these are possibly forms that visitors or listeners to the show would have seen before. They're quite a standard pre-printed form, and you have little boxes where the operator has written out the five letters that they've taken down off the Morse code, and at the top there's other information like the, you know, the, their set number and the frequency they're listening to, things like that. These are quite standard forms, aren't they?
Yeah, they would have been through many thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of these forms over the years. And relatively few survive. But yes, as you say, they have been exhibited in various places around the park.
One of the problems, I suppose, one of the fascinating complexities of telling the Bletchley Park story is when you make a statement, there's always an exception to it. And we're always saying, yes, at the start of the war, there's a big emphasis on dispatch riders. And we say, yes, at the start of the war, most traffic was brought here by dispatch rider. And they teleprint through a little bit of the messages to let the cryptanalysts start their work, but they bring the messages by road. But then by Bletchley Park's peak period, the teleprinter rooms are big enough that they can bring in almost all the traffic electronically, and then they just deliver the red forms as a backup. But the communications capacity isn't quite big enough to deliver everything, so some of the traffic is still brought in physical form, especially from the more local Y stations, like RAF Chicksands is a really good example. It's only about 20 miles from BP, and not all of the traffic they're intercepting is high enough priority to justify being teleprinted, so some of that is being brought physically, and it only exists in physical format. So that's one explanation as to why we see WT Red forms in our collection. But the other reason, as Craig mentioned, is that if there are problems in interception, if you've double-banked traffic, so you're intercepting it in more than one place or on more than one set at the same time, and you take those different copies and you amalgamate them together to make the best possible version later on, then the best version you have might be the red form rather than a version that's teleprinted from somewhere else. It might be that there've been problems in the teleprinter transmission, which means that's corrupted so that you have to go back to the original red form. So that's another reason why we see them in our collection, because they're swapped out for the teleprints later on in the process in Hut 6. We don't see, I don't think, duplicate messages which exist on red forms and teleprints. We can deduce from that that they've swapped one version for another.
Yes, and so there are basically two ways in which the teleprint can be a poorer representation of the intercept, one of which is simply a keying error on the part of the teleprinter operator. But also we see there's electrical noise on the teleprinter line, which can corrupt certain characters in the teleprints. If those corruptions are in an important part of the message, particularly if they're in the preamble with the discriminant or the message indicators, then that can seriously hamper the decryption.
So we see another type of message though, don't we, Craig?
We do. So there are a few messages in this collection which were intercepted overseas. So some in Egypt and some in Italy. Those actually arrive by quite a convoluted and complicated process.
So the form we see these on is called a WS4 form. And these are proformas that are printed with a kind of box again at the top of the sheet. It says WS4. I'm not sure what WS4 actually stands for. We haven't been able to deduce that. And unfortunately, it's the sort of thing that would have been blindingly obvious to everybody involved in the process. And therefore, nobody tells us what WS4 stands for. But these are quite consistent in format. And you've got, again, fields for filling in all the essential information about the intercept. But inevitably, below this box at the top of the sheet, you see not handwritten or teleprinted intercept, but intercept that's printed out on tape. And this is Typex tape. So they use Typex machines at Bletchley Park, famously for decrypting Enigma messages, but they also use them for incoming communications. Because when these are sent from overseas stations, they have to be sent by radio, and therefore they have to be encrypted at the interception point or nearby, and then they have to be transmitted back to Bletchley Park. And Bletchley Park has its own radio station, effectively, which is the auto room in Block E. And they collect this traffic, and then it's sent over to what's called the cipher office, where it's decrypted using Typex machines. So we've been able to deduce a certain amount about that process from these messages, and also from some other documentation we have. For example, we can tell that at the sending end of the link, of that radio link, sometimes several enemy messages were concatenated to form one transmission to Bletchley Park. And then when they arrive, they have to be separated out again. We see on some of the intercepts, which are on WS4 forms, because they've been typexed, we see basically gibberish at the end of the message, don't we, in some cases?
I had a bit of a revelation looking at that, in that you can see the gibberish characters are actually the bottom right three keys on a Typex keyboard. So it seems pretty clear that the Typex operator who's sending that message, or encrypting that message rather, is just mashing those keys for a few characters to make a space in the message.
And so when a transmission arrives at Bletchley, they've got to take it. They've got to work out where one enemy intercept ends and the other begins, which might be the purpose of that mashing of random punctuation. And then those individual intercepts can go over to the cipher office and be de-typexed. And they would arrive stuck down onto apparently a blue form, but we don't have any examples of those. So the Typex operator's job is to de-typex the message, to strip off the British encipherment and recover a different set of gibberish, which is the original German encipherment. You know, this is one of the reasons why this is some of the most tedious work to be done at Bletchley Park. And when they've de-typexed it properly, it will go over to a different part of the cipher office where it will be stuck down onto WS4 forms. And this is where those forms come in. And they will fill out the fields of those forms, which they can, based on the information they have at that time. And then you've got a version of an intercept that can go over to HUT-6 and be fed into the decryption process. And so those are the forms that we see in our collection. That's where they come from.
Thanks to British and Canadian troops who cleared the approaches to Antwerp, the first Allied supply ship sails into the liberated harbor, a Canadian-built victory ship. Admiral Ramsay, Royal Navy, a Dutch admiral, and representatives of the United Nations Army and Naval Staffs welcome the Fort Cataraqui on arrival. The skipper receives congratulations as his ship ties up preparatory to the unloading of vital supplies for the armies on the Western Front. Salt, tar, and foodstuffs comprise the first load. Soon munitions, petrol, and vehicles will pour in to reinforce the advancing armies. With the opening of Antwerp Harbor, lines of communication are shortened by some 100 miles. Supplies may thus be brought in great quantity right to our front door.
thus is speeded the victorious ending to the final phase of the war.
Now, everything up to this point has been how the message has been gathered and how it's got here. So the message is now finally in Hut 6. What's the next part of the process?
So they arrive off a conveyor belt, most of them. The teleprinter room in Block D is linked by conveyor belt to Hut 6, so they trundle along the corridor and they drop off the conveyor belt into some sort of basket in Hut 6, and this is where it all begins. And the first job is what's called registration. So arriving messages have to be sorted to work out what key they're in, where they're from, and you start that sort of filtering process, working out which messages have to be dealt with on a priority and trying to work out which of them have the features you need to actually break the traffic.
So the person sitting by the basket at the end of the conveyor belt was given a name by Hut 6. They were referred to as the kitten. And we're a little bit unclear as to exactly why they were called the kitten, but we do know in some detail what they actually did, because it is a role that's mentioned a lot in the official history of Hut 6. And what they did was taking the flow of messages coming from the Y stations, and they sorted them into piles according to the Enigma key that they were presumed to have been encrypted in. And the kitten had typed manuals telling them how to sort the traffic, typically based on a serial, but also on frequency that was noted at the top of the intercepts. And this role was evidently a very tedious one, because many references say it was the most boring job in the hut. There were two guides. There was an A guide, which was for intercepts that could be easily categorized, based on, as I say, either the A serial or the frequency, which would hopefully have dealt with the bulk of the traffic. But there was also a B guide, which then went to another sorting process based on other aspects of the message besides the A serial and the frequency. We know from a document that we are lucky to have a copy of in our archives, which is the diary of Pauline Leach, that there was a role in addition to the kitten that was referred to as the cat. Now, this is the only reference we have thus far found to there being a role called the cat.
And if you have any more information, please do let us know.
Please do. It's possible that it's actually a witticism that Pauline invented, in as much as a cat would supervise a kitten. We're not sure.
Of course, the other theory is that the cat predates the kitten. Maybe you had a role called categorization or cataloging, which becomes the cat, and then the kitten is the person who helps the cat, and later on the kittens come to sort of predominate, and we seem to lose the institutional memory of what the cat actually does, because they're not mentioned in the Hut 6 history, which is really strange. Well,
not by that name, indeed. So yes, we would love to find some other reference corroborating this usage of the term. But it is evident from Pauline Leach's diary that this was a very much more onerous role than that of the kitten. And there are many entries where she's bemoaning how difficult the task is and how bad she is at it.
26th of May, 1942. So, the first day is over. Fine and quite pleasant breakfast. Bus very early to Bletchley Park. I signed, I was introduced, and I was talked to. And then I began to do a little. But it was as double dutch to me. Lunch was there, home at last by bus. Supper, chatted, read, wrote and discovered church, unpacked. If things are really as they seem, I can't say how lucky I am. We shall see. 30th of May, 1942. A day much as the other days. I do not find the work interesting and see little possibility of it becoming so. Though, of course, it may be rather early to judge as yet. The people ought to be interesting, I think. 9th of June, 1942. Oh, again, late. Missed the bus, or rather, I consider that it missed me. Otherwise, little change. There a nice crowd in the registration room, on the whole. 25th of June, 1942. I catted. They're a very nice crowd, really, and some of them so helpful. 7th of July, 1942. I catted, or did I? It was literally a nightmare. 28th of July, 1942. Next Wednesday evening will probably see me in the deepest of abject misery. Catting. 2nd of August, 1942. Catted. Reasonably successfully. I was lucky, and Biddy really is so helpful. 18th of September, 1942. Catted. And even Biddy lost patience. 28th of September, 1942. Oh, such a dreary shift. I've never known one last so long. It was quite interminable. Misery. Catting. 7th of November, 1942. Catted. Demoted to kittening. Thank heaven. Ugh. 8th of November, 1942. Catted. Less said, the better. 1943. New Year's resolutions. Learn to cat by doing it twice a week and kittening once.
And there's another thing to say about registration, which is that, of course, there has to be another layer of complexity. This is Bletchley Park, after all. There is not just one registration room in Hut 6. There are actually two. We have registration room 1 and registration room 2. And this seems to be kind of a preliminary part of the process of, as I say, filtering messages to work out which you can use for decryption, ultimately. Registration room 1 is the main room, and it deals with all the operational high urgency traffic. But for non-operational keys, what they call research keys, they're kind of triaged out and sent down the corridor to registration room 2, and then they do the detailed registration of that traffic. But what we see just after when our messages are created is they have another of these reorganizations, and they decide registration room 1 is going to focus on Air Force traffic, and registration room 2 will deal with all Army traffic, which makes sense because Army traffic does tend to be a less current and lower priority and harder to break in general. So they seem to reorganize things to reflect that specialism. And we have a really interesting extract from the Hut 6 weekly report, which is produced the week after our red messages, talking about this reorganization. And I think it's fascinating because it alludes to the sort of dynamics in the hut in terms of the atmosphere in individual rooms and how it was important to kind of promote a sense of urgency and the problems that arose if you put teams too far apart, the problems that arose in giving them the necessary sense of urgency. So you have these dynamics which are quite different from the pure mechanics of how messages flow through the process.
In registration room 1, you have paper coming down the belt in a continuous stream. Tubes arriving with a bang. Keys announced out. The decoding room calling for the traffic. And in the watch, hungry bombs next door clamouring for menus. In general, an atmosphere which, at time of pressure, is filled with hurry and bustle. In research and registration room 2, none of these things is obvious to the naked eye, and clamour and bustle transmitted down the telephone is not nearly so effective. The pessimists may say it is impossible to develop and maintain a sense of urgency under such conditions. I believe not only that this is possible, but that registration room 2 will be very anxious to make it so. They may well have been feeling for some time past that they were left out of things, and that all the excitement and really important work was going on elsewhere. Moreover, as far, at least as the registration sections are concerned, the present situation seems to me far from satisfactory, and I do not see that there is any alternative solution in sight, so that whether the prospects are good or bad, we are bound to make the experiment, and to put forward every effort to make it a success. Extract from Hut 6 Report, weekend in Saturday, November the 11th, 1944, written by Stuart Milner Barry.
Having been sorted into piles by the kitten, the messages were then entered onto a form with just the key details from the German preambles of the message. And this form was called a blist, after a certain Michael Bannister, who came up with the original version of this. And this ensured that none of the messages would subsequently go astray in the various stages of processing.
I mean, that's the main factor, isn't it? Just to have a permanent record. We see the blist number on every one of our intercepts in red pencil, nice and prominent, so these can't go missing.
And in many of them, we actually see that it's been corrected. So they were actually wrongly sorted to start with on different keys, such as brown, and then corrected and put in the red pile.
They're still using the coloured pencils in 1944 to mark up the bliss numbers, which is really interesting because we know by that point they're long past the point of naming keys after colours because they've long ago run out of coloured pencils. But in certain cases, the practice continues. And the bliss themselves, that is a procedure which is developed really early in the war by Michael Bannister. But it still serves its purpose in kind of adapted form right at the end as well.
We actually have some examples of brown pencil for intercepts that were initially wrongly sorted. And there's another colour of pencil that I'm not entirely sure of, which is sort of violet or purple. I believe there was a violet key, so it might be that.
And then when you've blistered all your traffic, the messages are actually ready to go through to the main watch in Hut 6. And this is where the cryptanalysts finally start to assess them. And probably the most interesting thing we've been able to deduce about these red messages with some certainty, not absolute certainty, but we can make a strong argument in each case that we've been able to deduce how the red key was actually broken on each day. Because we have the full range of traffic, we can see all the cribs which they were applying. We can see some of the messages actually have bomb menus on them. And because we have the decrypts, we see the decrypted messages, we can, and again, this is not me, to be honest, this is mostly Craig, has been able to work out for each day what the most likely breaking process was.
The first stage of the cryptanalysis of the intercepts was performed in what was called the machine room section of Hut 6. And we can see pencil workings on many of the messages where they were trying cribs. And where the cribs appeared to be plausible, they have penciled in potential bomb menus. And for all of the 4 days, we can make a reasonable guess as to which intercept was the one that allowed them to break into the daily key for red for each day.
How cool is that?
I'm surprised we've got such detail, let alone actually being able to nail down out of these 300 odd messages we're talking about. For a certain day, the one message that someone sat in a room in Block D in Hut 6 and use that to break all of that day's messages. That's quite remarkable, isn't it?
It really is fascinating. You know, let's go through the days. So we've got 4 days, 1st to 4th of November. So on the first day, on the 1st of November, there's only one red message with a crib written on it, and it's a correct crib. And we can tell from the notes on the message that it was recognised as a duplicate of a message on the Puma key.
That would have been by matching the time of origin and the length of the message.
So on that message, we don't have the bomb menu, but we can say that that cryptanalysis was correct in that that was a re-encodement of another message on a different key. And therefore, they ought to have been able to use that to generate a bomb menu, and it should have worked and given them the red key for the day.
What is the actual crib for that day then? We've talked about cribs so often, but we've never given an example.
And
so this is
so
a first.
There's so many bad examples floating around out there. Hmm. Heil Hitler is probably the worst example because that never shows up. A crib actually looks like this. It's 31 letter crib and it says vor, nah, Aufklärung, sei Aufklärung.
And what's that translated?
It means something like second close reconnaissance, sea reconnaissance. So a particular German reconnaissance unit has gone out and it's performed a reconnaissance. I think this is probably one of the Mediterranean messages. And evidently they had a habit of prefixing all their reconnaissance reports with
the unit name, sort
of thing. The unit name and this little introduction.
Thank you very much.
Hut 6 knew that from having broken messages in the past, and it also knew that, of course, from this re-encodement from a different key. So that looks like the most likely candidate for how the key was broken on the 1st of November. We could do a similar sort of process for the 2nd of November. So on this day, there are 3 messages with cribs written on them. 2 of the cribs are incorrect, one of them's right. So again, with that last crib, which is an fünf Minensuch Staffel, we can say that could have been the basis for a successful bomb run. Now, the 3rd of November is particularly interesting. I don't know if you want to talk about this one, Craig.
The 3rd of November seems to have been a particularly challenging day for Hut 6 and the Red Key. And we can see that it actually wasn't broken on the day, that it was a few days later. We haven't exactly pinned down the day. That may have been in part because there were other priorities for the code-breaking staff. But we can also see that it was a particularly challenging day in terms of finding a suitable crib and a bomb menu. So we can see that there are at least 4 attempts at drawing up cribs and menus. And our best guess is that the longer cribs were tried first because they would require less bomb time to actually test. But as it turns out, the 3 longer cribs were not correct guesses. And it seems that they go back to the first message that they tried, which is a very short menu and causes a bomb run with a lot of stops that have to be individually tested. But that actually was a correct crib, and therefore we believe that was the way into the key some days after the message was actually intercepted.
That's worth pointing out is that they're breaking red for every day, and famously they break red for every day of the war, but they don't necessarily break it promptly at this stage in the war, just because it's too low priority and there's too many other important keys to break first, so they do end up breaking it a few days late some of the time. And then if we look at 4th of November, the last day, we see there's two very long cribs, which would have made good menus. They're both correct, so either of them could have been the basis of the break. But it seems in that case, they both relate to the identity of the unit sending the message. So again, this is probably a sign where traffic analysis is feeding into the cryptanalytic process. We have Neil Webster, who we talked about in our episode on traffic analysis, in Sixter, who's liaising with Hut 6 and trying to give them cribs based on his understanding of the German networks. And this is a really good example of where you can anticipate where an address would appear in a message and it would give you a reliable crib. So one of those was probably how they broke the messages for the 4th of November. The important point to make about the way Hut 6 cryptanalysis is working at this point is that they have enough bombs that basically their capacity to break keys is based on their bomb time. And they are putting together these weekly reports with statistics of how much bomb time they're spending to break each key. So it is a very statistical kind of factory-like process. And they're not doing a lot of the hand cryptanalysis to, you know, break individual elements of the cipher that they had to do earlier in the war because they didn't have enough bombs and they needed to reduce bomb time as much as possible. Now they can sort of brute force the problem to an extent, as long as you've got good cribs. You can just throw them at the bombs and you'll break the key sooner or later. But the point is, there are still other challenges, other problems that keep the cryptanalysts in Hut 6 busy. And we see some evidence of this in our red messages because of these mentions of UKWD.
Yes, so we know that the plug settings of the pluggable reflector D changed on the first of the month. And we see that in that the previous month's red key was using a set of plugs which were referred to by Bletchley Park as D90, and the November set of plugs they figured out and gave the name D96. But if we look at the intercepts that came in early on the 1st of November, it's evident that those that were enciphered with the pluggable reflector D were not able to be immediately decrypted. So we can see that sometime during the day of the 1st of November, that wiring was actually figured out, and that was then able to be passed on to the decoding room, who would then use that to decrypt the pertinent messages.
All the methods so far contemplated for breaking D, Duenna, Autoscritcher, Giant, etc., require a long crib, between 50 and 250 letters. This means that a large number of constatations will be used on each menu, and the risks due to corruption of texts will be high. A short analysis of texts was done in September and gave widely varying results. The corruption rate varied from 0.1% to 4.2% on well-duped texts, and from 4.6% to 8.4% on good unduped texts. A corruption rate of anything over 2% is extremely serious from the point of view of D-breaking methods. The results of the first analysis made it clear that we must take the corruption factor seriously, and a party was set up to investigate corruption further and see if any general rules can be devised. Messages taken were those which gave the worst results in the first analysis, namely the recce reports in the Mediterranean. They are often sent in both red and puma. Of the wrong letters, about 87% on the red and about 83% on the puma were wrong on every text, and therefore must have been due to errors on the part of the German encoders. The measure of accuracy reached was in fact rock bottom, i.e. it could not be improved by better interception on our part, since the errors were mostly made by the Germans themselves, and over this we have no control. All the texts so far analysed by the Corruption Statistics Party have been examined with a view to discovering which letters of the alphabet were most likely to be wrong. These letters could then sometimes be avoided in making up menus. Extracts from various Corruption Statistics Party reports.
So behind the process of breaking the individual daily keys, you've also got the process of breaking UKWD for every month. There's a number of other challenges that have to be dealt with. Then the reflector in use, it's only one of the factors that feeds into the actual decoding of messages. So once you've got the daily key, you can send all the red traffic through to the decoding room and run it through the Typex machines, which are set up to emulate Enigma. And the traffic should come out as German. But a lot of the time, of course, it doesn't. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. And then there is this whole process of working out what's gone wrong, either in the German part of the process or in the British part of the process, from interception through transmission to Bletchley Park through actual key finding, that means you can't decode particular messages.
So when you say German part of the process, do you mean that the German operator might have sent it incorrectly?
Or they might have encrypted it incorrectly.
Right, okay.
As well. The Germans make all sorts of mistakes, and sometimes you get messages through that even the Germans can't decrypt, and then there's not a lot HUT6 can do. But there's also so many steps in the British side of the process that can introduce error.
Right.
And uncertainty. And we see a lot of evidence on the messages of difficulties in the decoding process. Now, messages that went straight through, they will have the message indicators on Typex tape in the appropriate place on the intercept. The indicators are the element of the preamble that tells you how to position the rotors of the Enigma to decipher that particular message. And the same applies to Typex machines. So the Typex operator would decrypt the indicators, take that bit of tape and gum it on the intercept, and then they would be able to go ahead, hopefully, and decrypt the rest and, you know, reveal plain text German. When that doesn't happen, then there are a few stages in different parts of the HUT to resolving the problem.
Messages that didn't initially decrypt on the presumed settings were called duds, and there were various parties within the HUT6 organization that then attempted to try different settings and keys and so on in order to successfully decipher them. Looking at the statistics which we've put together for these 4 days of red key in November, there are an unusually high percentage of duds. So other materials suggest that a typical percentage would be less than 10% of messages requiring special handling. And overall, we see nearly 20% of these red messages. And in fact, on day one, the 1st of November, it's nearly 30%. Probably about half of that, though, is due to the other reflector being used between the fixed reflector B and the pluggable reflector D. So I'm suspecting that using the alternate reflector probably wasn't counted in the overall dud statistics. And we're getting closer to what's expected over the 4 days, then it is actually slightly less than 10% if you ignore alternate
reflectors. So that's just something that's routine for the decoding room to try, is to go, oh, let's try the other reflector.
The message doesn't leave the decoding room for the alternate reflector to be tried. In fact, it's probably passed along to the next Typex in the line, which would have been set up with the plugs of the reflector for that month and that key. However, if that simple attempt at breaking the dud fails, the process gets rather more involved. And I've actually spent quite a lot of time trying to piece this together to see what specifically happened at the time of these intercepts, because the structure within HUT6 did change a number of times throughout the war and was in the process of changing in October, November, December 1944. But what we've deduced is that there were essentially three groups, and these three groups seem to have kept more or less the same roles, even though they end up reporting along different lines and are situated in different rooms. That is what was at one point called the duds room, which was an adjunct to the machine room. There is what's called the duddery, which is what's commonly understood to be the department that does the most processing of these messages that won't come out. And there is also a section that at one point was called duds research. Now, as I say, it's a little bit difficult to piece this together from the official history because the names of these things have changed. The part of the machine room that tested different indicators had been allocated a room called the duds room in Block D when they first moved there in February 43. But that room was soon requisitioned for other purposes. So it seems that they were co-located with the machine room. But we actually do know of the individual who was in charge of trying these different indicators, which turns out to be a Miss Doreen Epperson. And we see her nickname, Epi, written on some of the red messages, which are therefore obviously marked for her personal attention. So she would go through a number of processes which aren't specifically described, trying different indicators in case the intercept had the characters of the indicator corrupted in its transmission to Hut 6. That was not always successful. And then the next stage would be to go to this group called the Duddery, who would try different keys in case that it had been wrongly sorted as belonging to the red key. And there was a pre-printed form, a sticker that was affixed to the intercept with a list of suggested keys to try. So we have some physical evidence of that part of the process.
So just to recap, you can have the wrong reflector in use, which is resolved in the decoding room. Right. You could have a corruption in transmission of the message indicators, which is resolved by Doreen Epperson. Or you could have a problem in registration and a message is assigned to the wrong key, and that's resolved in the Duddery.
But if we look at the floor plans that are shown in the official history of Hut 6, they don't appear to have had their own room at this time. So there's no room on the plan that's called the Duddery. And it's evident that they are part of the traffic identification section, which is another of these departments, sections within Hut 6 that's in flux at round about the time of these intercepts. So it transitions from being divided into processing what were called watch keys, which were kind of operational keys that were pretty much deciphered every day, and research keys, which was a longer term thing where they were typically messages that weren't even looked at until maybe 3 or 4 days after they were intercepted because the likelihood of deciphering these messages was low. And then the fourth backstop of all this was at one point of the war called Dud's Research. But by the time of these messages, it appears to have been referred to as sector investigation. So there were a group within the traffic identification section called sector investigators, and their role included trying to figure out if messages that had not deciphered successfully belonged to perhaps a new key or a key that was being used in a different way, perhaps with the pluggable reflector and so on. And that was a longer term research effort.
And the sectors in question, we're talking about, again, elements of the German communication networks. They're geographical, essentially, aren't they?
The sectors are essentially geographical. At one point, you would have had Eastern Front sector investigators and Western Front sector investigators. Also, you would have had sector investigators for the Air Force in the Nordic countries and the Air Force in the Balkans and so on. So they were very specialist in terms of the radio networks and so on that they looked at.
So they're trying to say, you know, the Luftwaffe in Norway, have they adopted a new key or have they adopted Reflector D or some other device maybe?
There's a degree of flux in the German military organization which is increasing at this stage of the war where new Luftwaffe divisions are being formed and disbanded. As part of that reorganization, they were often assigned new keys to use.
So keeping track of that, you can imagine it would be, you know, more than a full-time job.
Indeed.
You've been talking about all these different ways of deciphering them and decrypting them and looking for duds and things. Is there anything that slips through the process? Is there any that don't get decrypted?
Yes, there are. And by and large, these were discarded. But there is only one intercept in this collection that survives. And I believe it survives because it's part of a multi-part message that the other parts were successfully deciphered. But as far as we can tell, the indicators for that message were never successfully discovered, and there is no decrypt pasted to the back of the intercept, which is the case for all of the other ones.
But that attests to a pretty high success rate of these various sections, these various backstops, as you call them, making sure that they capture everything they possibly can from the messages that they've collected.
Yes, so there are some pieces of card that are part of the collection that are referred to as tick-off sheets. So they record the sort of top level of progress of processing of the intercepts through various departments, including Hut 6 and Sixter and Hut 3. And we can see on those that there are a few entries recorded as D which are not part of the collection. So they were seen to be dud and they were not kept. But it is quite few. It's a handful, six or seven perhaps.
And here with us in our New York studio for a summary of the situation on the Eastern Front is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The forward sweep of the powerful Russian left wing seems to have reached the outskirts of Budapest, though there are some indications that German resistance is stiffening in the immediate vicinity of the Hungarian capital. It remains to be seen whether this resistance is going to develop into a major battle for possession of the city. On present evidence, it seems more likely that it is just a covering operation to permit the Hungarian Nazi leaders and their German accomplices to get out of town before the Russians come in and add these gentry to their bag of war criminals. One point of importance remains in doubt. That is, whether the Russians will be able to get any of the bridges over the Danube intact. More than likely, the Germans will blow up these bridges before they retire. It's therefore quite possible that considerable fighting will take place as the Russians attempt to force a river crossing. They may do this in the city itself, but are more likely to make a swing north of the town, first to cut off any German elements which might try to retire towards Slovakia, and second to reach the Danube at a point where a forced crossing could be more readily developed than among the closely built structures of the city. If the Germans are to prevent these Russian accomplishments, they will need more troops and yet more troops. But more troops is something which the German high command cannot turn out in synthetic factories, however ingenious.
We've heard about all the processes that lead to the deciphering. What happens to the messages once they're deciphered?
That rather depends. As we previously mentioned, a lot of these red messages don't necessarily have useful military intelligence as part of them. But we do see quite a few of them that are marked with an annotation Z/L. And the Z, I think, is basically indicating that that will have special processing. And the L, we know, stands for Lithgow. And Major Lithgow was part of Sixter, and he kept track of the messages which pertained to traffic analysis. So these would be messages that announced a change of frequency or call right. signs and so on. So those messages were routed through to his section in Sixter. The remainder of the messages then went to Hut 3 for translation and assessment as to whether they are of intelligence value. So the output of Major Lithgow's section would in turn have been routed back to Hut 6 so that the traffic identification section could use this information about the changes in the German radio procedure to update the sorting guides, the A guide and the B guide, that are then used in the registration room, so which loops us back to the beginning of where the messages come into Hut 6.
So even a non-strategically important, simple message could play back into the whole system and become quite important.
Absolutely, because the change of frequency, it could be a unit which is now using the pluggable reflector when they previously on that frequency used the fixed reflector.
And then tomorrow you break the message that you really need to read.
Now, Craig just mentioned Hut 3. Obviously, this episode is mainly about Hut 6. But the whole point of what Hut 6 are doing is to send this intelligence, or these decrypts that will become intelligence, to Hut 3, don't they?
Yeah, so again, yeah, I don't want to talk about the process in Hut 3 in a lot of detail, but the really important point to make here is that, again, messages arriving in Hut 3 mostly are being filtered out in various ways and are not being reported directly to the customers. The final destination for most is they kind of pass directly through Hut 3 and end up in what's called the German book room. This is a catalogue, I suppose, of all message decrypts in the original German, which Hut 3 can refer back to as and when they need to. So they compile everything that comes into the hut in these German books. And it's a room mostly staffed by women with lots of typewriters, typing away all day into these German books.
These are stored in the original German then. So for example, when we look at, you know, a PDF from Q of 1,000 messages that are in English, that it's not that sort of thing.
No, it's important to capture the original German because then if there's an error or maybe an ambiguity in translation that comes about,
right.
you can go back and check the original.
Ah, okay.
And everybody, of course, in Hut 3 speaks pretty good German, so they can work off the German decrypts. They don't have to work off the English versions. And the reason these German books are valuable is because it allows everybody involved in the process to consult them and squeeze all the possible value out of the decrypts. So you could bring in your traffic analysts again to check up on particular lines of research. All your backroom watches in Hut 3 doing long-term research can consult the books. The indexers, actually, who are absolutely vital, they're mostly working off the German books, looking for phrases which they haven't recorded in the index before and filing them away. So that's vital. And again, it's fascinating to link this to the documents we have because we can see from some of the Hut 3 watch notes, as they're called, basically memos sent around the hut, how important the markings on the actual decrypts are to making this whole German bookroom process work.
The difficulties of book reading are increased by the general uncertainty as to whether individual paragraphs have been reported or not. Sometimes the decodes have not been marked before typing. Sometimes the German bookroom has overlooked the marks. Thus, a great deal of time has been wasted by 3M, checking through to see whether reportable items, all apparently, though not really, overlooked, had been sent up in that series. Please take this to heart and don't forget: A. To mark your decodes. B. To mark them in such a way that they catch the typist's eye at once, preferably coloured pencil and on top, as the report and teleprint number is typed at the head of each message in the German book. Extract from the Hut 3 watch note, number 139, 22nd of October, 1944.
So out of these red messages from early November 1944, have we got any evidence that any of them actually went out to a commander in the field?
We do, and you know, after being able to explain how the keys were probably broken, this is the coolest thing about this collection, is that some of them do produce actionable intelligence, and they are sent out to commanders.
Brilliant.
Hut 3's got a few different ways of doing this. Sometimes they issue a decrypt as a report, so it's typed up and put in a bag and sent to the ministries down in London physically, low priority, just for their information. Out of our over 200 messages, we have 21 reports of that sort. We have 24 teleprints, so they're higher priority, sent to London by a faster route. And some of the teleprints, they form the basis of signals to commands, which are normally where we focus. You know, when I did the post D-Day episode, I was looking at those messages to commanders, which you normally call ultra signals.
Yep.
Out of our collection, we've got 18 of those. So it's only a very small proportion. It's less than 10%. And most of those decrypts we see are pretty mundane. We haven't got any outstandingly important messages here. The highest priority that go out as ultra signals are 3Z out of 5Z, highest priority. So none of them are stop press sort of intelligence. But it's, again, that's useful because it's representative of Enigma traffic, especially on the red key at this point in the war.
Kind of day-to-day work.
Yeah, exactly. It's only in use where they don't have a specialist key, so you'd expect the real important operational traffic to be on the specialist keys. But
yeah,
red is generating some important intelligence as well. There's all sorts of points of detail in there about movements of German units, movements of planes, accounts of sorties, intelligence that goes to traffic analysts about, you know, reorganizations of radio plan and things like that. We've got a couple of reports which stand out from the crowd. I think one that's kind of geeky interest to me is one that lays out the format of a return that's been requested to a German parachute unit. So they've said, we want figures to fit under all these categories. And that would have been given to the section in Hut 3 that specialised in interpreting pro forma documents. And then when a reply comes through, which is just a list of numbers under headings, but the headings aren't labelled, they'd be able to fit them into the pro forma that they previously decrypted and understand what they're reporting, which is, you know, quite a nice reminder of the necessity of joining all these messages up. There's another report which wasn't regarded as, you know, important enough to send on as a signal because it was old intelligence. But it reports the shooting down of a mosquito over Norway, which had been on an anti-shipping raid. And we're able to say what mosquito it was. It was mosquito HP-967 of number 235 squadron. And the pilot and the navigator were both killed. And that was Flying Officer Harold Llewellyn Powell of the RNZAF, the Royal New Zealand Air Force, and Flying Officer Norman Lewis Redford of the Royal Australian Air Force. And so they reported that decrypts, of course, so the Air Ministry could learn the fate of the aircraft if it wasn't already known.
Special report on the 4th of November 1944. A low-flying mosquito was shot down by concentrated infantry fire, one machine gun and seven rifles, from an aircraft reporting post near Flora at the entrance to North Fjord. it crashed in flames on land.
If we look at the decrypts that go out as ultra signals to commands, again, quite an interesting selection. So there's one part of a signal about the strength of an ME262 training unit, which might have made interesting reading. There's quite a few orders, because they're using the red key for reconnaissance aircraft in the Balkans, there's a few signals relating to the fighting there against the Soviets. The Soviets by that point are pushing into Serbia and Kosovo. So there are orders for air support on what the Germans refer to as the Pristina Front, and a report about evacuating wounded and 3 tons of mica. Mica being a substance, I believe, is used in construction, in things like insulation.
Right.
So it's certain industrial uses. So the Germans are partly interested in their own men and partly interested in extracting as much raw material as they can ahead of the advancing Soviets.
In latter years, that you used mica as part of manufacturing paper tapes, but whether they did in the war, I don't know.
There may have been a signals intelligence reason for it. I mean, it's interesting that these two examples that you've given, they perfectly explain what's important and what isn't important. For the general day-to-day running of the war, it's not particularly important to know the fate of one single mosquito. It's necessary to be able to tell the families of those two poor pilots that they're lost in action. Whereas in November 1944, wanting to know possibly how many Germans are being trained to fly this new super wonder weapon, the ME-262, is kind of important, isn't it?
Yeah, you can see, and definitely that's the theme in the messages that are being reported at a higher level, that they have a slightly wider relevance. And I suppose there's quite often an assumption that Ultra is primarily interested in what's happening on the battlefronts and what's sort of tactical. And I think this undermines that quite clearly. It's the messages where you can deduce a bit more about the German war effort more widely that are really important. So another example that we see several of is reconnaissance reports from the Germans. And you can see again, it helps you build up a picture of what the enemy know, and it complements your own picture of the situation as well. You can corroborate that with other sources and cross-reference.
Recce by Nahaufklärungsgruppe 12 on the 1st included unspecified aircraft up from 1325 to 1340 hours on recce of Adriatic. Sortie broken off owing to engine trouble and weather. No further ops carried out owing to weather.
Again, with the hut-free stage of the process, we can use the markings on our messages and the markings on the ultra signals in their various forms, the various ways they're reported, to piece together what's going on and work out whose hands that material is passing through. So if you look at an ultra signal that's reported to commands, you have 3 initials on it. The initials are the emender in hut-free, the duty officer who checks their work, and the typist who types up the final signal before it's sent out. And sometimes we can name those people. And because we can link that ultra signal to one of our decrypts, and the decrypts have the emendations on, we know who made those pencil marks on the original Typex tape. It's come to the back of the original intercept, which is really cool. We can cross-reference those with our roll of honour and put names to them. A name which we do see come up here will be very familiar to our listeners, Ralph Bennett, who writes about ultra after the war. RFB, his initials appear on some of the ultra, which is reported from our signal. So we know. He didn't amend them because he was a duty officer by that point, so he would have just been checking, but possibly he amended some of these signals, or at least they passed through his hands when he was working in Hut 3. And that's pretty cool to
do. I was going to say, that is
really
quite cool, yeah.
Puts the person back in the story. We know he was... We could probably... I haven't done it, but we could probably work out when he was on shift that day based on when the traffic comes through. A key lesson from these decrypts is how easy it is in this very manual process at every stage for mistakes to occur. So Craig actually found a really good example. There's a message which gives the address of the Ostministerium in Berlin. So it's the Nazi Ministry for the Eastern Territories.
Yep.
And they report this. And if you look at the decrypt, the word Ostministerium is spelled correctly. But if you look at the report, it's all sort of garbled. It comes out as Ostministerium, which is a complete made-up word. And something's gone wrong there. And I think what must have happened is you had a handwritten chit with the English translation on that went through to the Hut-Free typist. And the typist has misread what was written on the chit and rendered it as something which really isn't German. But by that point, they're working at such pace that that message, you know, somebody who clearly had a shaky grasp of German was in charge of typing up, and that slipped through. So obviously, whoever received that at the Air Ministry or the Admiralty or wherever would have very easily corrected it. But it's telling us about some of these mistakes we see throughout the process are quite telling of, again, the human factor in it and what could go wrong. But looking in its totality about where these messages end up, at the end of the day, it's a very useful snapshot of exactly what Hutfree does, exactly the sort of intelligence that's produced in what sort of proportions from the traffic coming through every day.
Advancing up the Adriatic, Canadian units of the 8th Army exploit advantages gained in their dogged struggle to drive the Nazis out of northern Italy. With the enemy defense in great depth, the job is a tough one. Near Torre Pedreri, supporting infantry, 7.2 howitzers go into crash action. With the enemy pinning down our troops from close range with a mortar barrage, battery signalers transmit fire orders for counter-mortar fire. Great Churchill flame-throwing tanks of the very latest design receive a workup. Nothing can stand up to the hell which spurts from its fiery spout. As Canadian units move on Cesena, a terrific mortar duel takes place. Mortar crews work overtime to pour a deadly stream of lead into stubbornly resisting Germans. The enemy barrage keeps up from strong defensive points across the Savio River to the west of the city. Battered streets echo to the rumbling of tanks and trucks. There is only time for a breather before pushing on to clear the next objective. One of the first prisoners to be brought in takes a dim view of the whole affair. Whether he is on strength of a Jerry cookhouse or a Canadian prisoner, he is only potential pork chops.
Now, I know that it was probably a good 6 to 9 months ago that you suggested we did this episode, Tom. How much work have the two of you put into this? And I'm guessing you started it, Craig.
Well, yes, I did start it just because I was intrigued by all of the extra information I was seeing beyond my initial task of figuring out what order these pieces of paper should be in. So yeah, that's when I started typing it all up, started actually decrypting some of the messages on a computer simulation, and that's how we figured out they were definitely all of the red key, because at that point we weren't sure that's what the red pencil meant, but yes, it is all in the red key. So I just got increasingly engrossed in that. And fortunately, Dean, the archivist, indulged me and gave me access beyond what I would normally have had.
And then did you take this to Tom?
I did. I can't really remember exactly how we started. I think you popped by the archives and I said, oh, look, you'll be interested in this. And we took it from there.
Yeah, I seem to recall I was pretty sceptical at first that there was anything that important here. Because as you say, you look at these messages and they seem like, my assumption was they survived because they were not significant. Because we quite often find that stuff falls through the cracks and it's the valuable stuff that is kept track of and then it's hoovered up at the end of the war and, as far as we know, normally destroyed. So my assumption was here is something that's unimportant that's fallen through the cracks somewhere. But Craig's sort of almost experimental archaeology to try and reconstruct some of the process was vital to proving exactly what these were and exactly how significant they were, tracking down, you know, the eventual intelligence as reported and all this. So I have to give credit to him for many, many weeks of work, really, to do all this.
I hesitate to add it all up. It's definitely hundreds of hours, probably thousands.
Yes, and I just came in relatively late in the process to add what context I could. I was fascinated because I like the process. I like knowing about the process in its detail. And it always bothers me when you get this quite Baudelaireized, simplified description of what people like to call the path of a message. And I'm always saying to people, there's no path of a message. There are hundreds, thousands of paths of a message through Bletchley Park. And having a collection here where we can now take an intercept from German unit through interception, through decryption, to final reporting, and follow it every step of the way in the process and physically in terms of where it was located geographically, outside and inside Bletchley Park, it does all that work for us to understand at least one of those message paths.
Are there any general overarching conclusions you can come to?
It's a mind-bogglingly complex process. There are so many steps here. There is so much that has to happen and be done properly. And, you know, it's a cliche because we say it all the time, but this really proves, you know, you had these people at Bletchley, paper would pass their desk and they didn't really get where it came from or where it was going. But they did understand that they needed to deal with both quickly and accurately. Otherwise, it would cause problems. And we have so much evidence here of how true that was. So we do see all sorts of mistakes.
I particularly love the one that goes back and forth between different bits of Hut 3 and at the end has massive capital letters scrawled on in bold hand. Radar is a watch matter. So it was a kind of dispute as to where this particular message should be rooted, whether it was, as it evidently concluded, it was a watch matter, or whether it was a traffic analysis thing. So it shuffled back and forth between these two departments. I think that's a sign of the pressure they were under. It's like, you know, I can't deal with this extra piece of paper on my desk. Why is it here?
And a good example of how the pieces of paper themselves are the means of communication, because nobody is overseeing all this. You know, Stuart Milner Barry in Hut 6 and Eric Jones in Hut 3 sort of understand it at a very big level, but they can't supervise all of this. No one person can. And I suppose that teaches you a lot about how you organise these systems. I don't know, Craig, you'll probably have a better understanding of appreciation of this than me with your professional background, but how you orchestrate all these different processes so that together they produce the result you want, even though nobody quite controls the whole thing. I think it's something that it's hard to understand how that can work, but it does.
Well, it's evident that there was a continual kind of optimization of the process, hence all of the reorganizations that happened at various points. So I was going to make the point that one of my takeaways is, if you're describing the processes of Hut 6 and Hut 3, you have to say it's this point in time that we're talking about, because at least from the organizational level, there were pretty major changes. But then as we drill down to the details, as we both quite like to do, I think it's evident that the individuals involved tended to keep in the roles that they were good at, whether they were called the quiet watch or whether they were called sector investigators. They still did essentially the same job. It's just that the reporting lines were different.
Yeah, Doreen Epperson going under who knows how many titles during her time in Hut 6, but right. Just getting better and better at deciphering indicators.
Yeah, and the fact that there are so many timestamps on these messages also indicates that there was a sort of management level that was looking at how can we optimize the time between these intercepts arriving and the intelligence coming out at the other end. It's fascinating stuff. And a lot of the tiny details, like exactly which room this timestamp sat in, we still don't know. We can make guesses at a lot of it, but we're still looking for, you know, primary references in various materials in the National Archives and so on to try and support these guesses.
Because, of course, everything we work out, every mystery that we solve, it raises two more questions. But, you know, that's kind of how we like it. That's why it's so fascinating. I suppose coming in and looking at those decrypts, initially you're surprised by how much goes wrong and how much room there is for error in the system. But the more you read about how it worked, the really amazing thing is that despite all those kind of inevitable problems, it is a really effective system. It works incredibly well.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.